The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome back, everyone. This is our luncheon presentation, where before we begin our third and fourth panels of the afternoon, we have a speaker who can address either directly or indirectly, you can get to be the judge of that, much of the subject matter involved here. And what can I say about Mike Isikoff beyond what is already in the extensive biographical information that you have in your handouts? You can see from that Mike is the winner of many awards for investigative journalism for Newsweek, and now he's also a contributor on MSNBC. I can tell you that I have liked Mike and had tremendous respect for him ever since I had to throw him out of my office in October of 1993. I don't know if you remember that, Mike, but we were rolling out the Janet Reno FOIA memorandum, and we did that down in a press facility on the first floor of the Justice Department, and before I knew it, Mike was in the elevator like a good investigative journalist following me up to the seventh floor, and he worked for the Washington Post back then went on to greater fame and glory, Newsweek. And he is no less dogged and has been no less dedicated in his pursuit of facts and justice through facts through a wide range of scandals and controversies and you name it ever since. So without taking up any more time, let me give you Mike Isikoff. Please help me welcome him.
Thank you, Dan. I hope... You won't take any offense to this, but I've been thrown out of so many offices, I actually don't remember you doing that. It's such a routine thing over the years. Anyway, as I was thinking about what I might say here today, last night, while watching the election returns from Massachusetts, it occurred to me that the transparency that I might really like as a journalist is transparency into what Rahm Emanuel was saying while he was watching the returns from coming in from Massachusetts. It may not be transparency I could publish in Newsweek or most daily newspapers. But,
I don't think you could even utter it on cable.
Right, probably not even on cable. I think after 10 o'clock or something you can, on premium channels, you can get away with
what time
quite a bit.
Rachel Maddow
before
10 o'clock?
That, yeah, she's 9 to 10. Anyway, I guess I'll give you sort of a journalist's perspective on the first year of the Obama transparency record and how it's gone. I actually spoke, I guess, last March at one of Dan's conferences and said, great rhetoric, but let's see how they deliver before I'm willing to sort of make any pronouncements. And I'll go through a sort of checklist, but I just thought as a little test here, I know we've had, I don't see too many other or any other journalists in the room, or there might be a couple, but I know.
Max is over there recording
every
word, Mike.
Great. I see some people from some public interest groups and others who request, have occasion to use FOIA. And, of course, one of the big hallmarks of the transparency initiative is the Holder memoranda setting the new, much tougher threshold for withholding documents of foreseeable harm. As a little test, how many people here in this room have filed FOIA requests with a U.S. government agency in the last year? I see maybe about a third. Okay. How many of you have gotten documents in response to the FOIA requests that you filed? A rather smaller number.
Documents, or in fairness, a no records response, because that could always be the case.
I'm sorry?
It's not
Let me take it a little further. How many have actually gotten the documents that you thought you might have a reasonable shot at getting? Steve Aftergood has two. I see three responses. Okay. Good. Well, you got a better record than I have. I've got one FOIA request I thought I had a pretty good shot at getting something out of and haven't gotten a single document. So I don't know. Maybe I didn't word it correctly. Maybe I was asking too much. But
Sign your name?
I did indeed, and that may have been the
guessing here.
No, could have been. But I think the responses do show that what I think everybody will agree is at best a mixed record here. We haven't seen a revolution in government transparency. We haven't seen the vaults of government documents opened up to sunshine. We've seen some good rhetoric, some good shifts in tone, but not a whole lot of change in practice. And in some high-profile areas, I think there's reason to be discouraged. Now, just walking through the sort of checklist, and I forgive me if I'm being repetitive of what others have said, but just from my perspective covering this, there was a lot of excitement and interest early on in the spring when the long-sought Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel memos were released, or not in their entirety, but a great extent. And that did shed some light on what was going on in the formulation of counterterrorism policies in the early years of the Bush administration. I should say that most of the more significant ones had already been leaked or been disclosed. We didn't learn quite as dramatic new information as we might have hoped, but we did learn some, and there was some pretty interesting material in it, and I don't mean to diminish it. It is worth mentioning as a caveat, because this is worth keeping in mind, that was in response to litigation, and it was in response to a judge's order that these documents should be released, and that Obama holder Justice Department had the choice of either fighting to continue to resist disclosure of Bush administration documents or to accept what was a legal order to disclose them. And this does get to a point that I think I made last year when I spoke at the conference. It's all well and good to promise transparency about what the last administration did. It becomes a lot more difficult to uphold and fight for transparency when it's your own administration. That's an issue. But I'll get to that later. In any case, April, we had the OLC memos. Shortly after that, Justice Department was facing another court order, and that was to release the photographs of detainee abuse in both Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo. As an aside, photographs are not documents, but they can be pretty significant. As somebody who covered the Abu Ghraib scandal and its aftermath, I can tell you that it was not until those photographs were aired on 60 Minutes and then published in newspapers and magazines around the country that the whole issue of detainee abuse galvanized public attention and forced government responses. In fact, it was in the aftermath of the publication of the photos that the first John Yoo memos at the Justice Department began to leak out. I got a hold of some of them. The Washington Post got a hold of others. And we've got the first real glimpse into the legal thinking behind the kinds of aggressive interrogation techniques that were being used by the Defense Department and the CIA, and which many believe ultimately led to the kind of horrific abuse at Abu Ghraib. In any case, so you had a court order from a federal judge in New York to release these photos. The Justice Department concluded there was no real grounds to resist that court order. The White House Counsel's Office signed off on disclosure of the photos. And then the pushback began. The Defense Department, the Secretary of Defense, and military commanders in the field all made direct appeals to the White House, in some cases to the President, and President Obama, faced with opposition from his military commanders, chose to opt on the side of non-disclosure rather than to fulfill his commitment to transparency, and also required him to appeal a federal judge's order to disclose the photographs, and ultimately had led to the White House support of legislation to bar the courts from ordering what they were about to release. So from the step back of now we had legislation by the Congress to prohibit something that only a year ago a federal judge said the law required disclosure of, I think one can argue is a not insignificant retreat in the cause of greater transparency and openness in government. Not an insignificant development. It was it was all through this time that the Justice Department was staking out positions in state secrets cases that were identical to the positions taken by the Bush Justice Department. In fact, when that first happened, just a few days after President Obama took office, the federal judge in San Francisco who was hearing the case actually was somewhat taken aback to hear the new administration's lawyers, their career lawyers for the Justice Department, but they were taking the position of the administration, support the state secrets privilege to shut down the lawsuit in the Jeppesen case being the probably one of the two or three most significant state secrets cases out there involving allegations of that a Boeing subsidiary was assisting with the CIA's extraordinary rendition program of flying detainees to countries that practiced torture. The federal judge pressed the Justice Department lawyer in that, are you sure your position here has been vetted at the higher levels? The Justice Department lawyer said, yes, I'm speaking for this administration. And in fact, as events unfolded, it became increasingly clear in appellate cases, because the federal judge in that case did deny the government's motion to invoke state secrets to shut down the lawsuit in its entirety. And that's what these cases were all about. It's not plaintiff's lawyers going in there and saying, we don't accept the fact that there's classified information here. We don't believe that there's anything here that must be withheld. It was a challenge to the argument that merely a government assertion that classified information is so inextricably interwoven into the case that the case cannot be heard is enough to shut the case down without judicial review. And I should say, as another aside, that you know this whole issue was really one of the bigger battles and controversies of the Bush administration years, and the fight over secrecy was the remarkable degree to which the Bush administration was using the state secrets privilege, which had, of course, been used before, in a much more assertive and frequent way to shut down any judicial inquiries into what the government was doing. In any case, the government, the Holder Justice Department, continued to press in the Jefferson case. It filed state secrets privilege claims in the Jewell case, which is one about warrantless wiretapping, all while it was announcing that it was going to have a new policy on state secrets. It was going to review these cases. It was going to try to come up with a more reasoned position in actual cases on the ground. They continued to stake out the exact same arguments as the Bush administration had staked out. In fact, so similar to the arguments that the last thing I wrote on this was the government's filing in the appellate review of the Jewell case, which is the warrantless wiretapping case, a case filed by people who are claiming that their phone conversations were illegally listened to by the National Security Agency under President Bush's warrantless wiretapping law. And the government submitted a series of affidavits from top intelligence officials in the government, Admiral Blair, who is the director of national intelligence, was one of those, and a senior official in the Defense Department, whose name escapes me now. And I happened to take a look at the past filing of the of affidavits by the Bush administration, by the people who had those jobs in the past. In the case of the Director of National Intelligence, it was Mike McConnell, who had been Bush's Director of National Intelligence. And the affidavits were, in some cases, word for word identical. It was as though they had just taken the same affidavits, and the affidavits are the affidavits saying, here is my understanding of the facts of this case, and simply photocopied them and inserted them into the record as the position of the government position being the same. Again, not exactly a dramatic blow for transparency. I want to mention one other item that caught my attention just recently, because again, it was an issue that came up during the Bush administration, and it might not seem at first blush about government transparency, but bear with me for a moment. Signing statements. You remember the big controversy about the frequency to which President Bush was attaching signing statements to legislation, saying Congress may pass this law, but it doesn't comport with my understanding of the constitutional prerogatives of my office, and therefore we may choose to disregard it. You know, these were, you know, the hawk on signing statements was David Addington, Dick Cheney's chief counsel, who basically didn't believe the Congress could pass any laws that impinged on the prerogatives of the president to do whatever he pleases. This became a big issue, and Charlie Savage, then of the Boston Globe, now the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize for documenting just how many times President Bush had used signing statements, which, again, like state secrets, had been used in the past, but were used with much more frequency during the Bush era than in the past, documenting how often President Bush was simply saying to Congress, pass what you want, I'll choose how I want to interpret the law. Charlie did quite an interesting follow-up, I thought, just a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times, because he was tracking how often the Obama White House was issuing signing statements on legislation. And early on, they had actually issued a few. The use of these things are not all that all that novel. It's how often you use them and the claims you make. But then he noticed that they had stopped about the time after it first got some public attention that they were using signing statements. They just stopped issuing them, leading to the question: does this mean that you now accept constitutionality of every law that the president has signed since, and are willing to accept that? And I think there were some of these bills, reconciliation bills, have all sorts of language in them with, you know, far and wide from the specific legislation that that it might be entitled under. And the response came back from the White House press office saying, no, we're not saying that exactly. We're just saying that we don't feel the need to issue the signing statements anymore. And I think the follow-up was, well, why not? I said, well, if we've previously expressed opposition to the legislation in Congress, then our position is already on the public record, and so therefore we don't have to issue a signing statement. And I kind of did a double take when I was reading that, meaning, well, okay, you take a lot of positions before Congress in a lot of different ways, testimony before subcommittees, letters that never get publicly disclosed, and you're telling us that if somewhere out there you've expressed opposition to a legislation, you no longer feel the need to issue a statement saying the president reserves the right not to follow this law. That's basically what the White House position was, and that struck me, whether they intended to or not, as a, you know, potentially quite significant setback for the cause of transparency and openness. At least you could say, under the David Addington school, we knew where they stood. Now I think we're in a territory where we may not know where they stand at all. You know, I'm not suggesting that was the reason they've taken this tack. I think the reason is they just wanted to save themselves the political embarrassment of people writing stories about how they were issuing signing statements. But the consequence of what they've done, I think, is not insignificant. I'll say one brief point more about some of the litigation. I meant to mention this earlier. State secrets is one of them. I happened to be in court, because I had a big interest in the subject, the day that the Holder Justice Department was arguing the case for not disclosing Vice President Cheney's FBI report on Vice President Cheney's interview in the Valerie Plame CIA leak case. I remember when that was first requested, it seemed like a pretty easy one, a layup, if you will, for the Obama administration to release Patrick Fitzgerald, who had been the special counsel in the Valerie Plame leak case, had told Congress he had no reason to object to disclosure. It's a closed case. It's over. There's no reason anymore. There's nothing ongoing that disclosure of that FBI report would influence. It was not grand jury information. It was a FBI interview of Cheney in his office, in his vice presidential office. FBI reports of this kind, FBI 302s, had been released many times in the past. The case was over, and it was about Cheney. You know, why should they? Why did they have a dog in that fight? And yet, the Justice Department lawyers, and this is a FOIA request. Remember, presumably a FOIA request that should have been analyzed through the new Holder standard of foreseeable harm. What's the foreseeable harm of letting the letting the public know what Dick Cheney said in a case that was ended 4 years ago in an interview he gave 5 years ago? The Justice Department lawyers made the argument before Judge Sullivan that, well, you know, there might be foreseeable harm because of some future case that the Justice Department might initiate against the White House in which a vice president or White House official might not want to cooperate if he or she thinks, you know, years down the road that it might get disclosed. In fact, it might subject them to being the object of ridicule on The Daily Show. Late night comics. So I guess that was how they were interpreting foreseeable harm. Some years down the road, some government official might be subject to ridicule on late night TV.
Didn't that lead to a segment on The Daily Show? It did not escape Jon Stewart's notice.
You would think so. In any case, Judge Sullivan did not buy this particular argument. He actually didn't order disclosure of the whole thing, but he ordered disclosure of much of it, and we ended up getting the report. But why the my hunch is, in many of these cases, what you had was, you know, government bureaucrats, government lawyers, just doing what they've always done, defending the position that they had taken before, trying to come up with arguments. Yes, the Attorney General of the United States might have signed this memorandum saying there should be new standards. Yes, the president may have said he wants everybody to uphold it, but, you know, it's my position at stake here. My position, as in I took this position before, you know, I'll be goddamned if I'm going to change it. I'll just come up with some new way of defending what I've done before. It strikes me as the kind of instance that sort of, rather dramatically shows you can say a lot from the top, but actually getting the troops down in the field to adhere to what you're saying is a much more difficult proposition. Look, I don't want to dump on them too much. It's good that they're saying the right things. It's good that there's initiatives out there that are designed to promote disclosure. As somebody who's interested in as much disclosure as possible, but my own experience, and having done this for a number of years, and getting thrown out of offices before Dan threw me out, and getting thrown out of offices after Dan threw me out, is the only way that you get real disclosure of information is through public pressure and the political process. And I'll cite, you know, a few examples very quickly. You know, everybody talks about how the Bush White House was the most secretive White House in decades, if not ever. Yet, it was during the Bush administration that we had two of the biggest disclosures of national security information in American history. And I'm speaking of the 9/11 Commission, which put into the public record a remarkable amount of information about the government's war on terrorism throughout the last 20 years, including, you know, presidential daily briefs, executive briefs, classified reports on what the government knew, what it didn't know about the threat of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And you go back and you look at it and you read that, you know, the text of their report, and there's really remarkable stuff. And that came just a little after the Senate Intelligence Committee report on Iraqi intelligence, which also contains a rather remarkable amount of information about previously classified documents about what the government knew about and suspected and didn't know about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, and quotes from internal CIA reports, quotes from internal CIA emails, quotes from other classified government reports that got declassified for the purpose of that report. And why did that take place? Because the Bush White House was suddenly interested in transparency in government? No, there was a political conflict over the monumental screw-ups that led to the debacle of George Bush's White House making claims about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction that turned out to be not to be true, and yet were used as the basis for the country to go to war. And the in the case of the 9/11 Commission, a real political controversy and public pressure over what the government knew about the threat of and didn't know about the threat of Osama bin Laden. And it was the combination of that political pressure with the public pressure and political pressure that forced disclosures. And at the end of the day, my own experience is not everything has to be on quite that level, but those are the levers that are used to force disclosure. You can have all the, you know, memorandas you want and all the initiatives and post all you want and improve processes, but at the end of the day, that's not what gets us what makes for appreciable difference in the disclosure of information. Ending on one, having given that sort of broad overview, I just want to make one actual practical suggestion here that does fit into the initiatives, and something that occurred to me listening to the last panel, and I want to end on that point.
That's part of the reason we asked speakers to come early,
right,
like you did.
Right, so
terrific.
That's right. Look, FOIA requests are, you know, kind of a crapshoot. You know, sometimes you can be surprised and get stuff. Other times you can go crazy saying, how can they possibly be denying what this seems this reasonable? And there's very little way of knowing how the process works and who's denying you what you want or what you think deserves to be aired and who's not. But, you know, many, many, many years ago, I used to cover state and local governments, including public service commissions. And public service commissions would often have, the people who set the rates for utilities would often have, I think most of them have the position of public advocate, somebody who's there to argue for the ratepayers in every proceeding. In any time the utility, you know, Pepco or Vepco, whoever files for a rate increase, there's somebody there to take the other side and turn it into an adversarial proceeding. It occurred to me that it might be useful for those who want to promote disclosure in the FOIA process to have something like a requester advocate in the office whose job it is to argue for disclosure and hold the people who are trying to prevent disclosures feet to the fire to really make the case of what that foreseeable harm is, why this document has to be held. Somebody who I, as a requester, could go to and say, how's it coming? You know, are you with me on this? Yes, I'm fighting for this. I think there is a reason to do something like this. There isn't any reason to withhold these documents, and I'm going to argue on your behalf for them. I think if the Obama administration was serious about promoting disclosure and egging the bureaucracy on, creating a position of that kind in every FOIA office might actually serve the goal. Anyway, on that note, I will end and be happy to take questions.
Throw it open for questions, yes. Yeah. Let me just mention on that last point, the closest thing we have to that right now is the lady who's standing right over there, Miriam Nisbet,
right,
playing that
opposite role. I know she is, but Miriam, you'd be happy to weigh in if you want to. I don't think you're getting in the weeds on individual FOIA requests. You're looking at a cosmic level, I believe, of how the agencies are doing overall, but to have somebody actually arguing the case for the requester might actually serve your purpose.
Actually, the ombudsman part of her responsibility might be more weedy than you think.
Okay, well.
And in fact, it is. But what you're looking for is someone to play that role in every single agency.
Yes.
And that, I think, is part of the intention behind the creation of the public liaisons, not necessarily that they would be advocates, and maybe that's something to strive for, but certainly that there is someone in every single agency, in every component, that a requester can call and find out what's going on, what the status is, and so forth. But I understand.
That's a big difference from an advocate.
I understand.
My point is to make it adversarial.
Whoa.
Okay. I think we should continue this discussion.
Very good.
Okay. Just a suggestion.
But we do have time for some questions.
Yeah.
And while anyone who has a question comes up to the microphone on either side, let me exercise my prerogative as a moderator here and ask a question of Mike. In the spirit of the Obama administration secrecy transparency scorecard, what would you say is your biggest transparency disappointment in the last year? And on the other side of the coin, or the ledger, so to speak, what do you think is the biggest bright spot from your perspective?
Well, look, it'd probably be something in the mix of what I talked about, the rundown I gave, because those are the ones that I paid the most attention to. I mean, I think the OLC memos was probably I think the OLC memos is probably, and the I didn't mention the CIA Office of Inspector General report interrogations and abuse by John Helgerson, which did get released over the summer. Although I got to say, even in that one, after they released it and started to take heat from the intelligence community, the response that Rahm Emanuel and some others in the White House gave is, most of this was already out. They were trying to really play it down and saying, the broad picture, of the kinds of abuses that took place in the CIA Enhanced Interrogation Program had already been emerged in the media. I don't mean to, therefore dismiss the whole thing. I'm just saying it is worth noting that was it. And,
The thing is, they made a significant disclosure, but then they tried to take all the fun out of it. Was that
well, more than taking fun of it, they tried to minimize it, suggesting that they really hadn't made such a big disclosure because they didn't want to take the political heat for it, because they were taking heat from the intelligence community and former CIA directors who were lobbying and giving them hell for daring to expose CIA secrets to the world.
Speaking of heat, this lady looks like she has a tough question for you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Sue Udry. I'm with the Defending Dissent Foundation. And I guess part of you've made me even more depressed. And part of that is not only are we kind of giving the Obama administration a scorecard, but we're giving the public a scorecard on secrecy and transparency, and we're giving Congress a scorecard. And it seems like almost even worse than the Obama administration are the public and the Congress. The public outcry is phenomenal whenever Obama does release something that he should be releasing, and then we have Congress passing laws saying, no, you can't release something that a judge told you you should release. So, you know, what does that say about where we're headed when the president is more willing to be transparent in some ways than the public is ready for him to be? Not to defend Obama.
Right. Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned Congress because I meant to mention this just as a aside. On December 30, Brian Lamb, who's the head of C-SPAN, wrote a letter to Speaker Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, John Boehner, saying, hey, you've got these really major health care bills that you're about to negotiate. How about letting us at C-SPAN cover them so the public could see what's going on, given that this is a somewhat significant piece of legislation. The public might have an interest in seeing how you're going to reconcile these bills. And he happened to quote from one Barack Obama, who said at a debate.
President Obama or Senator Obama?
Senator Obama.
Thank you.
Who at the time was familiar with how Congress worked, said in a debate on January 31, 2008, Democratic presidential campaign, that's what I will do in bringing all parties together, not negotiating behind closed doors, but bringing all parties together and broadcasting those negotiations on C-SPAN so the American people can see what the choices are. This was in the context of healthcare legislation, how he would see that healthcare legislation got passed. Last I checked, which was about 20 minutes before I talked, Brian Lamb had not gotten a response to his letter from either the Speaker or the Majority Leader. John Boehner, the Minority Leader, did respond and said, oh, he's all for airing negotiations. Of course, he doesn't want a bill at all, so it's like, the White House hasn't weighed in on this one either. But
anyway. Thank you for broadening our perspective on that, Mike.
Right.
Appreciate it very much. And I promise that if there is another time when, for whatever reason, I throw you out of my office, which is now here at the law school,
right,
it will be memorable indeed, even in context with others. Now, let me tell you, Mike back then was very gracious because I had the duty of trying to persuade him of something that happened to be true. That was the issuance of a memo by Webb Hubble in November of 1993, November 3rd, that had to do with White House records that was purely sort of a routine ministerial memo. As a matter of fact, it replaced one that was issued by Miriam Nisbet previously, but unfortunately it was issued on the very day that Whitewater broke. And Mike connected the dots, and he said, now come on, how coincidental could this be that Webb Hubble, who was a political confidant of President Clinton and the First Lady,
and a partner at the Rose Law Firm.
There you go.
Right. Yeah.
Issued a memorandum regarding White House records when this broke. And it just so happened that it was totally coincidental that the dots were there, but they didn't really connect. Oh. And I remember spending, I don't know, it seemed like 3 hours on the phone with Mike that evening, but it was probably only about 45 minutes persuading him that, yes, I happen to be the one who knows what truth is, and I can tell you that it really isn't so. And to his credit, he believed me. And it was true, and I always appreciated that. So again, thank you very much. And what we'll do is we'll turn to our third panel right away as we set up.